WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the tobacco industry cover-up. We talk with Philip Hiltz, the New York Times reporter who broke the story of the tobacco papers, over 4,000 secret documents from the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company. They revealed the results of secret experiments and showed that executives knew much more about the dangers of smoking than they ever let on and intentionally kept the information from the public. Hilt's new book, Smokescreen, is based on the documents. Also, the winners, the controversies, and the buzz at the Cannes International Film Festival, which ended last night. We talk with film critic John Powers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Divers in the Florida Everglades are searching the impact crater where the ValuJet plane crashed more than a week ago. All 110 people aboard were killed. Bob Witten reports.
Rain drums the swampy surface just above their heads as divers grope in the blackness for parts of Flight 592. They're looking for objects picked up on a special ground-penetrating radar within a tennis court-sized underwater crater. Searchers are especially anxious to recover the cockpit flight recorder and oxygen generators. They'll be looking for any further evidence of fire or explosion aboard the plane. The divers are wearing special suits brought in to protect them from the toxic mix of human and plant remains, jet fuel, and hydraulic fluid. Lightning within a tropical rainstorm over the Everglades at one point forced the divers out of the water, but they have resumed their search. For National Public Radio, I'm Bob Witten reporting.
The House Judiciary Committee is hearing from civil rights activists on church burnings in the South. The National Council of Churches says a spate of arson fires in black churches is racially motivated. The lawmakers are talking about whether the church fires are linked. The South Carolina newspaper, The State, says the National Council of Churches has criticized federal and local authorities about the fires. The council report says they've bullied church members and been lax in their investigation. The report adds that circumstances surrounding the burnings are similar and they've occurred on or near the civil rights holiday honoring Martin Luther King. The U.S. military is evacuating Americans from the Central African Republic. Mutinous troops and government forces have clashed in the streets of the capital. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
It's a violent situation, Secretary of State Warren Christopher told reporters in Washington. We're concerned about American personnel, and we're trying to do everything we can to ensure their safety and to evacuate those who can leave. According to wire service reports, one flight has already departed with Americans on board. More flights are planned. An estimated 250 U.S. citizens live in the Central African Republic. The Marine contingent guarding the American embassy in Bangui has been reinforced. France, the former colonial power, has also sent troops to help restore order. Efforts are underway to negotiate an end to the mutiny, the second in 2 months. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Authorities in Dar es Salaam say nearly 600 passengers may have perished in a ship that sank off Tanzania. State radio says a steamship went down in Lake Victoria off Tanzania's northwest coast. Passing ships have pulled only 40 survivors from the water. Witnesses aboard two nearby vessels say many passengers were trapped inside the ship and are feared dead. Lake Victoria is the world's second largest freshwater lake after Lake Superior. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 6 points at 5,742. This is NPR. Extreme heat is expected again along the East Coast. Several cities reached record highs yesterday. New York City was at 96 degrees, Newark, New Jersey got to 99, and it was 97 in Norfolk, Virginia. In Delaware, the warmth caused the pavement on I-95 to crack, snarling rush hour traffic. Children were sent home early in North Carolina because of the heat, and school officials plan to do the same again today. Weather forecasters say relief is on the way. They say a cool front with thunderstorms is moving into the east. Senator Bob Dole campaigns in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin today. He's expected to use his visit to outline his proposal for welfare reform. Annalise Hensel of member station WUWM reports.
Senator Dole plans to visit with employees of Brenner Tank in Fond du Lac. The company has been working with a Wisconsin pilot program to get welfare recipients into the workplace. Then Dole is expected to outline his own plan to reform welfare in an address to business leaders. The senator has been critical of President Clinton, who has announced support of a Wisconsin law that will end aid to families with dependent children next year. He's accused the president of, quote, petty theft of a GOP campaign issue. Details of Dole's plan aren't yet clear, but some say he'll call for mandatory drug testing of welfare recipients, as well as a lifetime 5-year cap on benefits. For National Public Radio, I'm Annalise Hensel reporting.
Air traffic authorities say a computer malfunction caused flight delays at Newark, Kennedy, and LaGuardia airports last night. Departing flights were held up for as long as 70 minutes. A Federal Aviation Administration spokesman says there was no loss of contact between pilots and controllers, and safety was not affected. The main computer system at the FAA's Regional Air Traffic Control Center on Long Island failed twice between 6 and 8:30 p.m. A backup system did kick in. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was only 2 years ago that the heads of 7 U.S. tobacco companies swore to a congressional committee that nicotine and cigarettes aren't addictive. My guest, Philip Hiltz, covered the story for the New York Times, where he's a health and health policy reporter. Shortly after that story was published, secret documents that have become known as the tobacco papers were leaked to Hiltz. These papers reveal that tobacco executives intentionally covered up the results of studies dating back to the 1950s that showed the damaging effects of smoking. Hiltz also broke the story of a safer, virtually smokeless cigarette one company hopes to market soon. Hiltz has a new book called Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. It's largely based on the tobacco papers that were leaked to him in 1994.
These were about 4,000 pages of material from inside the companies, inside Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation in Louisville. They were memos from one executive to another, from one research scientist to another inside the company, studies that they had done. These were papers that the company was looking at. They were in court. This is the paper start in about 1957, and they run to about 1991. They were in court, and the plaintiffs were asking for papers continuously during this time. And company had to sort through all the documents they had in their office, that is to say, every stick of paper that they could find over this 30, 40, 50-year period. And so they got together a group of paralegals and lawyers to sift through the documents and find out relevant material. So these papers were the best of those searches.
And how did you become the lucky reporter to get them?
I'm not sure exactly how I was the one picked, but the person who pulled them out of Brown Williamson, this is a fellow named Merrill Williams, an unemployed character at the time, a drama major in college. He was unemployed, and then he picked up this job as a paralegal, and he carried these documents out and gave them to a lawyer, who then gave them to someone in Congress, who then gave them to me. I guess I had been covering tobacco for the New York Times already for 6 months or so at the time and had written a number of stories, and so I guess it seemed like the logical place to go.
What were your responsibilities as a reporter before going public with the story of these papers? What did you have to check out first?
First, I had to look at the papers. In the beginning, they didn't tell me where they came from. They just said, we want you to look at these papers. We're a little nervous about this, and we're not sure what we're going to do, but look at them. So I went through the papers and tried to check, for example, who wrote a memo and what year, and go back and see if that was the right person in that job at that time in the company and so on. So it was kind of internal checks. But the documents from the beginning, it was obviously genuine material. The companies, when I called them and said, I have these papers, they immediately said, yes, these are genuine. In fact, they're stolen. Why don't you give them back?
Yeah, sure. They must have been shocked and quite dismayed when you called and said, we've got the papers.
Yes, I think they were. They were upset, and they said, you can't use these papers. You must bring them back. And then they subpoenaed me. That was May, I guess, of 1994.
And your reaction to the subpoena?
Well, it's fairly normal in newspapers for these kind of things to happen. It was kind of stimulating in a way. I got more and more interested as they got more and more upset, because it meant to me that we were getting somewhere. This was stuff that they cared about. It's kind of exciting.
What would you sum up as the most damning information in the documents?
In all of the documents, that's the Brown and Williamson ones plus others we've had since, I think the most damning material is about children. I think the main subject about tobacco is children and how the companies behave toward children. And there are documents which talk about marketing to 12-year-olds. There are documents which talk about sitting 16-year-olds down and interviewing them at great length about what ads they like and what cigarettes they smoke and why they smoke and whether they're thinking of quitting and what they could do to prevent them from quitting and so on. I think these are the things that are most damaging.
What did companies do to market to 12-year-olds?
The documents show that their greatest concern is from age 12 to about age 17. This is the time when kids are just forming up their own image of themselves. They're in their own heads. They're making an idea for themselves of who they will be. And they pick up a certain kind of clothing, a certain kind of music, and so on. And at that same time, they're being offered cigarettes, essentially, in the convenience stores where they go in to buy sodas and whatnot. There are Joe Camel, and there's Marlboro Man, and so on. And these things are pitched directly to them. T-shirts with the logos on them, caps, lighters, paraphernalia of various kinds. And they take these promotional items and they put them in the stores nearest the junior high schools and high schools. And they advertise in the magazines and newspapers that the kids read that have high youth readership, for example, Rolling Stone or Sports Illustrated is a big one, and so on. These are the various kinds of tactics they use.
My guest is Philip Hiltz, the New York Times longtime health and science policy correspondent. His new book is called Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. Let's go back to 1953. This is a year that the top heads of most of the cigarette companies gathered in one place for an unprecedented meeting. And this meeting was in response to some damning scientific research. What was the research that provoked this meeting?
There were two things that happened in 1952 and 1953. The first was they discovered that they did a study of British doctors, and they found that there was a very high rate of lung cancer among men who smoked, and it went up directly as a relation to the number of cigarettes you smoke. You smoke half a pack, there's a certain amount of additional lung cancers. You smoke a pack, it's twice as much, and it keeps going up like that. So it was fairly clear that tobacco was the thing causing this big outbreak of lung cancers. And then in 1953, Ernst Winder, a scientist here in the U.S., took the tobacco tars out of smoke and painted them on the backs of mice. and this produced a huge number of tumors. So that you had the statistical evidence that there was a connection, and then you had the physical evidence that this tar could cause tumors on real skin. And these two things together made it clear that cigarettes were really quite hazardous, much more hazardous than anyone had thought. The Winder story was also the first time that the hazards of smoking had been on the front pages of the newspapers. So within a week after that story about the painting on the backs of the mice, the top executives of the companies met at the Plaza Hotel in New York to lay a plan what to do about it.
What was their plan?
The plan was denial. They thought, well, we could admit this, and we could go ahead and accept some kind of regulation. But let's not do that. Let's first find out what we can on our own in our own labs. Maybe we can even fix the hazard and not have to talk about it. We could just find out what is the thing in tobacco that's causing this problem and take it out, and then cigarettes will be okay. So in the meanwhile, what we will do is we'll deny it. We'll say there's no problem with cigarettes, and we'll launch a program, what they called Entirely Pro-Cigarettes Program. That is to say, they would have PR efforts, they would have scientific research, in theory scientific research, and push this year after year that there was no problem, that the cigarettes and the disease were not necessarily connected, it was just a statistical quirk and so on, while at the same time they were saying that in their own labs they were working on what the hazard was and how to get rid of it.
It was at this meeting that the Tobacco Industry Research Committee was born, and this is basically
yes.
the forerunner of the Tobacco Institute, which became the major PR and lobbying arm.
Yes, there are two outfits out there now. Yeah, the Council for Tobacco Research and the Tobacco Institute. The Tobacco Institute is the political arm in Washington. The CTR is in New York, and it's the scientific end. They founded the TIRC after they had run a full-page ad in 400 newspapers around the country saying, well, we've heard that there is this hazard, so we're going to investigate it ourselves, and we'll tell you what we come up with. So they established this research group, and they were, at least as far as the public was concerned, they were going to research the question of health and tobacco and whether this was really a problem or not. In fact, it was only a front. They didn't do any tobacco and health research. They did a good deal of research on other topics, but none of it on tobacco and health.
And they needed to find doctors who were willing to say that cigarettes and cancer were indirectly linked. And they managed to find a retired founder of the National Cancer Institute
yes.
who was perfectly happy to say that and who believed it, too.
Yes, Clarence Cook Little. I'm not sure what he believed in the end, but his thing in life was the genetics of cancer, and he thought cancer was pretty much going to be predetermined by your own genes. If you have a certain kind of defect, you'll get this kind of cancer. If you have another kind of defect, you get another kind. So then he thought, well, there are people predisposed to smoking and to cancer, I mean, from smoking, so that the smoking itself is not the problem. It's your own genes that are the problem. He built a big laboratory based on those ideas of genetics and cancer. And so when they came along and asked him, will you come and work with us on this subject, he said, yes, I believe that environmental factors in cancer are really not very important. I think it's really our own genes that are the problem, and we don't need to worry about the environment.
I thought it was interesting that much of the response to the damning scientific research that was being done, much of the response in 1953 was dreamed up by a public relations committee. And what you point out was still a very new business. Public relations was really getting started in the 1950s, modern public relations.
That's right. The companies being very profitable, I mean, they have a lot of extra money that other industries don't have, are the ones who get into these things first. For example, advertising. The tobacco industry developed advertising in the United States. They were the first ones in there. And then when PR came along, the idea of PR in the early 1950s, they were there and they made use of it more than anyone else. You could say that they really sort of started the PR industry. The PR outfit in this case was Hill & Knowlton, and John Hill was the head of it, the founder of it, and he worked with the tobacco companies.
You say one of the things that that the tobacco industry came up with was dirty tricks, campaigns to undermine the credibility of adversaries. What did they come up with?
They did quite a few different things. They had an intelligence network, and whenever they found a scientist was going to speak on the topic, he had done a research study and he was going to talk about it, they would send somebody to argue with him in scientific meetings. There was one person who did some work for them named Freddie Homburger, and he did a research study about the effect of smoking on of animals who breathe in the smoke from tobacco and whether it would cause tumors. It was thought that it wouldn't show up any tumors because animals have different systems for breathing than we do. They're nose breathers, for example, so you wouldn't have the same kind of problem in the lungs because the particles are all pulled out. But it did show up. There were quite a few cancers of the larynx and the lungs and whatnot in these animals. And so he was going to announce this at a press conference. And the companies found out about it ahead of time. They went to his house. They said, we're pulling your funding. You can't do any more of this work. And in fact, we have the right to edit your work. So we're going to strike out the word cancer in each place where you mention it in your paper. And this press conference, he thought he was going to hold it still. He went to the meeting. He went to the press conference. And there was no one there. They had canceled it without his knowing. Hmm. It's that sort of business.
My guest is Philip Hiltz, health and science policy correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Philip Hiltz, the New York Times reporter who broke the story of the secret tobacco industry papers. He's also the author of the new book, Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. While the tobacco industry was publicly denying that smoking was hazardous to the health of smokers, it was sponsoring research inside the industry to find out what the offending chemicals were in cigarettes, that the cigarette industry can remove those chemicals and basically offer safer cigarettes. What kind of research were they conducting to find out what the offensive materials were?
It was a full range of laboratory research, testing on animals, testing in the lungs, testing, you know, painting on the backs like Ernst Winder had done, and so on, to see the relationship between the tumors and the smoke. There were also things on heart disease. Various kinds of questions were brought up. How exactly does the smoke cause each different kind of disease? So they did a huge amount of research, more than anyone on the outside. And what they discovered was that it wasn't one substance involved. It wasn't two or five or ten. It was hundreds of different substances that are toxic, and they wouldn't be able to take them out. They could filter a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but fundamentally the hazard comes from burning these substances. They produce carcinogenic substances when you burn the leaves. So you take one out, you still have 12 left. It was a real problem for them. And so it turned out that they would have to completely redesign cigarettes, take out the tobacco completely, or make it so that they don't burn but just heat up the tobacco or something, some completely radical procedure if they were going to make them safer. And they made those designs, but then they put them on the shelf.
I think one of the strangest responses that you reprint from transcripts in your book Smokescreen happened in 19... I guess, it was the year of the Cipollone versus
1988?
Tobacco case, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the head of the Liggett Tobacco Company was on the stand, and he was being asked about research that the company had sponsored, in which they found that the elements in cigarettes were causing tumors on mice. And he said that they were really conducting these experiments to try to reduce the tumors on the backs of mice.
Right. And he was asked, you mean this has nothing to do with humans? It has to do with mice only? You're really working on spending all this money, a couple million dollars or whatever, just to save mice from their tumors? And he said, yes. That's the problem that the companies have, is that they know all these things. And in private, sometimes they'll answer honestly. But in public, they believe that if they tell what's actually gone on, they'll be open to suits and they'll lose the suits. So in public, they have to say they don't know, or they have to mislead in one way or another.
But now that the cigarette papers have been made public, that strategy can't work anymore, can it?
I don't think so. I don't think it could ever work, really, except that it delays the day when they will have to face the music. That's their basic strategy is not so much that they're trying to win this battle. They know they're going to lose the battle, but they want to make it go very slowly, put off the day when the profits will drop, when the number of cigarette smokers will go down, when the regulations come on.
Now, how did Merrill Williams actually smuggle out the documents so that they could ultimately be leaked to you? He was the paralegal who worked at Brown and Williams.
Yeah. His job was to identify the most damaging documents, and he did that day to day. He read through thousands and thousands of pages, and he picked out ones that looked like they would give the tobacco companies problems.
Would he just take them out in his briefcase at the end of the day?
No, he didn't have a briefcase, and the security was quite tight. So he took the papers and he put them down his shirt, or sometimes he rolled them up and put them in his socks, and he would walk out. He would go and have them Xeroxed and then bring them back. He did this over quite a long period of time, 2 or 3 years he was working at it, a few pages at a time. And, of course, they built up in his apartment. He kept them under his couch, trying to hide them. And it just kept going on that way, one document after another.
Has anyone in the industry ever tried to get back at him for leaking the documents?
Yes, he's in court now, and he has been in court ever since they leaked. They are charging him with theft of the documents, not technically theft, but theft of the information in them, violating his confidentiality agreement with the company and so on. So they're after him in court. He hasn't gone to jail yet, but that may be the result.
What kind of sentence does he face if he's found guilty?
It's pretty much up to the court, because it would be a contempt charge. It would be something that the court would get to decide. There's a big range for it, but it could be some jail time, a few years. It depends.
The tobacco industry knew from its own research that nicotine was addictive and that it had a tranquilizing effect on many smokers. Did the industry see that as a pro or a con?
That was a pro for them, basically. This was the center of their product. This is what they're really offering to people, and they said that in their documents early on, that they were selling an addictive substance that was very useful in coping with the stress of life. It's kind of relaxing and alerting at the same time. It's a drug that they thought was really quite remarkable. They also worried at times. There was a time when they were using the nicotine in the cigarettes, but tranquilizers were new, and they worried that doctors would start prescribing tranquilizers and people would stop smoking. They would not need to have the stress reducer anymore. So they tried to position themselves just in case to make other drugs or to find other things that would be similarly stimulating or calming and so on. So from the beginning, they were aware that they were in the drug business.
But they tried to keep that aspect of it a secret from the public, didn't they? I mean, you wouldn't see ads saying, it's addictive and has a tranquilizing effect.
Actually, they talked about that. They talked about whether they could do that. They were worried that children, for example, when they're starting, they start for completely psychological reasons. They don't start because they're thinking they're going to get into a great drug. And they talked about the possibility of advertising that this is really a wonderful, calming product. They decided in the end they couldn't do it because it would be too hazardous for their legal position. Mm-hmm. They thought they might lose cases that way.
Now, chemically, could they have come up with a process that took nicotine out of cigarettes?
Yes, they did very early on. And they tested various kinds of things with more nicotine, with less nicotine, with no nicotine. In the 60s and 70s, they ran through the full gamut of tests, so they could do anything they wanted with nicotine.
But they didn't take it out?
No, they didn't take it out because they found that people wouldn't smoke if they took it out. Smokers, the phrase they use is satisfy. They want to satisfy the smoker. That is to say, the smoker has to feel the hit from nicotine. And if it's not there, they switch cigarettes immediately.
Philip Hiltz writes about health and health policy for the New York Times. His new book is called Smokescreen. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, safer cigarettes and the future of the tobacco industry. We continue our discussion with Philip Hiltz, author of the new book Smokescreen. Hiltz broke the story of the virtually smokeless cigarette. And film critic John Powers reports on the Cannes International Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times reporter Philip Hiltz. His new book, Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up, is largely based on the tobacco papers, secret internal documents from the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company that were leaked to Hiltz. Hiltz says that in spite of their denials, tobacco executives have known that nicotine is addictive and hazardous to the health of smokers. Although they had the capability of lowering nicotine levels, they intentionally kept those levels high enough to be addictive. Now, in the early days of the low-tar cigarette, the companies kept nicotine levels high, even though they were removing tars, and they could have removed nicotine.
Yes, level is important. It's not so much that it has to be high. It has to be just enough. It has to be enough so the smoker gets what he needs in the way of a hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drug effect. You're kind of dosing yourself. And so if you have it too high, it gets too harsh. People don't like that, except in some countries. There are some European countries that have very high nicotine. But the people in this country like a kind of a moderate amount. And they've found the physical range, the exact numbers of what range you have to have this in order to satisfy smokers. It gets below that, they stop smoking. They go to another cigarette. Gets above that, it gets too harsh. They change cigarettes.
So they had to figure out a process by which they could keep the tar low, but the nicotine at the level that smokers wanted and needed the nicotine.
Right. As they were dropping the tar, the nicotine came down with it. Traditionally, that's the way it worked. If you pull out the tar, you use lighter tobaccos, the nicotine goes down. So they had to pull these two things apart, essentially. They let the tar drop down and keep the nicotine up at a level where people cared about it.
How did they do that?
There are various systems. One is to use ammonia, for example. You dose it a little bit with ammonia, and that frees up the nicotine that's in the cigarette so that a greater percentage of it goes from the tobacco to your lungs. There are these kind of tactics that are used.
You say that early on in this period when they were trying to separate the level of tar and nicotine, that they would try squirting more nicotine onto tobacco leaves, but that never worked very well.
No, that got it too harsh, because if you taste nicotine, it doesn't really have a taste. It has this very nasty acid-like impact on the back of your throat. And that's the problem with having too much. So you have to mix it up and balance it. It's like making a fine wine, really. You have to balance these tastes and feel in the mouth. And when they just squirt the nicotine directly on, that was too much.
Now, you write about the FDA uncovering the tobacco industry's pursuit of super nicotine tobacco. What's that about?
Yes, this is another tactic they used. This is Brown & Williamson Company trying to have a very high nicotine tobacco so that when you drop the tar down, you still have enough nicotine in the cigarette. So they made this tobacco. They grew up this tobacco. They bred it, actually, genetically, so that instead of 2% or 4% nicotine, they had 6 or 7% nicotine in the leaves. Well, actually, it turns out that for one reason or another in the history, you can't grow high nicotine tobacco in the United States. It's illegal. So they shipped it to Brazil. They shipped the seeds there, and they grew it up there, and then they shipped the tobacco back into the United States. And this was something that is, in fact, it's illegal, and they're right now going into court on smuggling charges because they smuggled the seeds out and the tobacco back. This was another one of those tactics to keep the nicotine level up as the tar was dropping down. And the FDA got onto their trail, and they found the company that had done the basic biological research and actually made the seeds and so on and tracked it back that way.
You say by 1975, five tobacco companies had designed and tested successful, safer cigarettes. But the companies couldn't afford to offer those cigarettes, so the companies put the designs in the closet. Why couldn't they market these safer cigarettes?
Probably they could have, but they were afraid. Their lawyers told them that if they put a safer cigarette on the market, when they say safer, of course, that means the other things they were making are dangerous. And they were not about to admit that everything they were making was dangerous and that they had been doing this all the way along. So they were afraid the admission they would make just by putting it on the market. So they never did. And this is still a major issue. There are no safer cigarettes out there now because of that, even though all the companies have them on the shelf.
Will there be a so-called safer cigarette on the market soon, do you think?
I don't know. It's if the companies are regulated, if the president and the FDA succeed in putting some kind of regulations on the company, then they may be free to go ahead and put out a safer cigarette, in which case they probably will, and it should have a significant impact. In fact, I think this may be the future of tobacco if you have a completely different kind of cigarette that has the taste and some nicotine, but is maybe one-tenth as hazardous, because 10% of the lung tumors or whatnot.
Tell us what you know about the safer cigarette, how it compares to a regular cigarette.
There is one that is now being manufactured but not sold by the R.J. Reynolds Company. And it's essentially heating up the tobacco rather than burning it. So then in the front end, you light a little piece of charcoal. You can't see it because it's in the inside the cigarette paper. But when you light the cigarette, the charcoal gets lit. And the charcoal acts like a coal, just like a charcoal briquette on your barbecue. It heats up, and then the hot air goes through and picks up the nicotine and the flavor from the tobacco and comes out the other side, so that it's about half as hot. It's not burning, so you don't get all the carcinogens. You get a much lower number of them, so that presumably it's somewhat safer, although we haven't actually tested it. The way you test it, of course, is let people smoke for 20 years and then find out what's going on.
So if it's not actually burning, are you not inhaling smoke?
You're inhaling a lot less smoke and a different kind of smoke. The composition of the smoke is quite different. It's more water and glycerin and so on, products that are lifted out of the tobacco by the warmth of the air passing by. So it's really quite different. And in fact, the end of the cigarette, very little smoke comes off it. I've been in a room with someone smoking one of these things. You couldn't tell that somebody was smoking in the room because it's very, very light smoke.
Have you tried one yourself?
I have. This was in North Carolina when I first went down to see what they were doing with them. I used to smoke myself for 10 years, and I liked it, but I quit because of health problems. My wife was pregnant and asked me to quit with her, and we did. But since I had smoked, I thought it would be kind of interesting to taste these things. They're actually pretty good. They taste pretty much like a cigarette.
You know, I have so many dreams where I light up again after not having smoked for, yes, you know, so long. And as soon as I take one puff, I feel like, oh, it's all over. All those years of stopping in vain, I'm hooked again. Yeah. Were you afraid to try the safer cigarette thinking that you'd be hooked again?
I wasn't. I wasn't worried at all about it. Now I am. Because afterwards, after taking it and after spending some time in these plants, I love the smell of the tobacco. And, you know, I kind of long for the hit again of the nicotine. So I'm a little bit worried about going back. I don't think I will, but yeah, it's bothered me somewhat.
My guest is Philip Hiltz. His new book is called Smokescreen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the tobacco industry with New York Times reporter Philip Hiltz. What's the next step for the FDA's proposed regulation of the cigarette industry?
This summer, they will announce their final proposal for how they want to regulate the cigarette industry. It will be probably September or August, maybe. And the proposal will be focused on children. That is to say, it will talk about banning vending machines. It will talk about eliminating advertising in certain kind of media, for example, magazines that go mainly to children or largely to children. Those ads would be banned or changed. And there would be a campaign, an educational campaign. The companies would have to put in $150 million every year, and anti-tobacco ads run on television, radio, newspapers, and whatnot, so that the companies would be doing their own anti-tobacco advertising, in a sense. This is the heart of their proposal, is to try to cut down on the demand, and that is to say, kids between 11 and 17, these are the ones who start smoking, and without this, there would be no big market later on. So the FDA wanted to cut off access, or stop people from smoking before they start, and then the smokers who are already smoking, the adults and so on, just forget about that. Let them be out there. Let the cigarettes be sold to them. But try to cut off the children's end.
Do you think that the FDA will get its regulations through?
They will put the regulation out. Then they will be taken to court. Probably the way the law works with the federal government is they will probably, the court will say, yes, you have the right to regulate. The courts give a lot of leeway to agencies, and when the agencies are doing their work and showing legal responsibility and so on. So they probably will get it through court. Then the question is, what happens after the courts say, yes, you can regulate? Does Congress intervene? And that, I think, is the real question. And that may not happen this year or next year or maybe the year after. But sooner or later, it will come down to Congress and whether Congress decides to short-circuit the FDA.
In your book, Smokescreen, you ask the question, why has the tobacco industry been so successful in having a favorable Congress when there's only like six tobacco states in the country? And you came up with some interesting suggestions that might answer that question.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny situation. In a democracy, you tend to think that the representatives are listening to the voters and voting pretty much the way the voters would like. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in there. But it turns out there is a quirk in that, and that is the votes have to be public. The people have to know what the representatives are doing. And the way the tobacco politics has worked, the representatives take the money from the tobacco companies. They take fairly large amounts of money as campaign money goes. For example, Bob Dole has taken about $60,000, $70,000 over the last 9 years. This is very useful for them. What happens then is when an anti-tobacco bill comes up, a tobacco control bill, say one that did pass eventually, that there was the one that not smoking on airlines, preventing smoking on airlines. The bill comes up. It has to go through a committee, a subcommittee, a committee, a full committee. Then it has to go to the floor and so on. So this long process, 6 months or a year or more, it's kind of hidden legislatively. It's unrecorded votes in committee. And this is where the effect is. If a congressman takes money and he votes with tobacco in committee, where the public can't see it, that's generally how the power process works in Washington, and also in state legislatures. The state legislatures have the same system essentially, that many votes are taken privately, and this is where they have their big effect. If it gets up to the floor where it's a big vote publicly and everybody's watching, the votes tend to go the other way. They tend to be against tobacco. So the main job is to keep them off the floor, the main job for the tobacco industry.
What do you think is the future of the tobacco industry?
I think it'll always be there. We're talking about a product that has been around for a couple thousand years and is not going away. I mean, people do like to smoke. There's no way you're going to stop people from smoking. You know, if you shut down the industry in this country, the cigarettes will leak in over the borders. There will be ways people will get cigarettes. It's never going away. It may decline. We have now 26% of the population smoking. Maybe it goes down to 15% or 10%, and then it stops. That's the number of smokers we will have permanently. So I think the companies will always be there. I think they may change their products. They may get safer products, products that are less irritating in secondhand smoke, give off very little smoke so that others can be around the smoking. The products will change. And if the companies are making fewer cigarettes for this country, they will be selling to other countries. This is their major point in the future is, if we stop here, we're going to look to Thailand, we're going to look to Korea, we're going to look to third world countries. This is where they're selling now.
You said that you think one of the true casualties in this story of the tobacco industry is the cigarette itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, as I said before, I did smoke myself for 10 years, and I liked it. And I liked the flavor of tobacco and the smell of it. But the cigarettes of the old days were real tobacco, cured, wrapped up in paper, and you just light it. It was that simple. Now, the cigarettes are not really tobacco anymore. Only about half of it is tobacco. The other stuff is stuff. In fact, they sweep up junk off the floor and dump it into the cigarette. There's this reconstituted sheet, they call it. This is the stems are chopped up and mashed and made into a kind of paper, and then they squirt some tobacco juice on it and chop it up to make it look like tobacco, but it's not. It's a kind of a stem paper. So what's in a cigarette is quite different than it used to be.
What's the purpose of using all that other stuff in the cigarette? Is it to save money or what?
It is. That's where they started. They thought, well, we're using, in the beginning, they used only the big, bright leaves in the middle of the tobacco plant. Then they said, well, maybe if we use more leaves, maybe we use the stem, we use the dirt, whatever, we could, you know, this is poundage we can put into the cigarette. So it saved them quite a bit. 10, 20, 30% of the price of a cigarette can be saved by using the junk. You just have to make sure the flavor is still okay. And they do that. They squirt the flavor back on and so on. But it's, you know, it's quite an engineering process now. It's not just chopping down the tobacco and putting it in paper.
Now, you stopped smoking after about 10 years.
Yes.
How long ago did you stop?
Let's see. That was when I was 28 years old. So that's about 15 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. So are there still people who you are very close to who smoke?
Yes. My father, who is now 75, and he smoked, I guess, 45, 50 years now. In fact, the other day, he called and he said, you know, I've quit smoking. It's terrific news. And we were all happy for him. But then a few days later, he called back and said, well, I just can't do it. I can't. He's a writer. And he said he couldn't write without his smoking. So he's back on. And my son, who is now 21, started on Camels 5 years ago. And it's very sad. And there's not much you can do to convince kids when they're off on their own not to smoke. And he does.
Do you ever try to use the information that you've uncovered in your book as ammunition to help your father or your son stop smoking?
To a limited degree. I mean, you can talk to them. You can say, listen, you realize how bad this is. But they do realize how bad it is. That's the problem, is that they know perfectly well how bad it is. It's just that they can't quit. It's a serious motivational problem. They are in the thrall of nicotine.
Do you find yourself getting, like, personally angry with cigarette companies, or is this just, you know, a story for you?
The times when you get personally angry are the times when you're talking to the tobacco company people themselves, and they're lying to you, and they're jerking you around. Those are the times that get you upset, because you have, you have papers. You're talking to them. You're saying, "Now, doesn't this show such and such?" And they say, "No, no, it doesn't. That's all completely wrong." And then they give you some phony story. That's the point when you get angry. You really like to be treated like an intelligent person, like you can see for yourself what the document says, and so on. So yes, you get angry at those moments. As for the long picture, I don't think angry. I think it's more sadness about the whole situation. It's a human tragedy that's pretty extraordinary. You're talking about from a time in the 1800s when there was virtually no lung cancer to a time now when 110,000 people die a year from lung cancer. Another 300,000 die from heart disease directly related to smoking and so on. These are new diseases. These are out of no place. It's a public health disaster, and we know what the cause is. But we aren't able to bring ourselves to a position of dealing with it politically, socially. And I think that's what's interesting to me, and it's a sad, interesting story.
Philip Hiltz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Philip Hiltz's new book is called Smokescreen. Coming up, the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. The Cannes International Film Festival on the French Riviera is probably the most important film festival in the world. Filmmakers, critics, distributors, and dealmakers come from around the world. Fans line the streets looking for stars. But this year's festival was notable for its absence of big-name glamour. Last night, the festival concluded with the awards presentation. The directing prize went to Joel Coen for Fargo. The top prize, the Palme d'Or, went to the film Secrets and Lies by British director Mike Leigh, who also made High Hopes, Life is Sweet, and Naked. Right after the awards presentation, we called Cannes to talk with Fresh Air film critic John Powers, who was there on assignment for his magazine Vogue. We asked him about Secrets and Lies.
This particular film starts with a kind of hooky guess who's coming to dinner premise. A young black woman in London who was adopted tries to find her birth mother, and she finds her birth mother, and she's sort of the London equivalent of white trash. And this throws the whole family into a chaos of self-revelation, and all the secrets and lies of the family come out in the course of the film.
Mm. Now, which were the films that probably most resent not having won?
Yes, well, actually, the film that finished second, which is a film called Breaking the Waves, which was in fact the favorite to win the Palme d'Or by a slight margin, which was a Danish film about a young woman whose husband is crippled in an accident, and in order to keep their love and him alive, he asks her to go and have sex with strangers, and then tell him about it, in order to keep his imagination alive. That was a very popular film, and it introduced a young actress by the name of Emily Watson, who'd never made a film before, who went from being nobody at the beginning of the screening to, by the end, being someone that everyone thought was going to be a major international star.
Hmm. John, what was the most controversial film at the festival?
The most controversial film of the festival, and of many festivals, I think, is David Cronenberg's film Crash, which is based on a novel by J.G. Ballard. And it essentially posits a slightly futuristic society in which people are essentially affectless or almost emotionless, and they're looking for emotions. And the way they find emotions and try to find connection is through sex. So the film actually opens with three straight sex scenes and then moves into a series of car crashes which trigger emotional responses which lead to more and more kinky sex scenes. It's actually, for about 25 minutes, an incredibly brilliant film. It's actually moody and smart and kinky and all those things. I think it goes off the rails after a while and starts seeming very repetitious. I think it must be the first film in history where people are constantly having sex after car crashes and the audience is bored.
What movies are you most enthusiastic about opening in the States?
Well, actually, probably the ones I'm most enthusiastic about are the ones that seem to win the prizes. I mean, Secrets and Lies is an extremely good film, and I think most people who see it will genuinely like it. It has extraordinary emotional cathartic power. On the other side, one of the films that will probably be a great success was a film called The Eighth Day, which I think perhaps was the worst film here, and perhaps one of the worst films I've ever seen, about a businessman who doesn't know how to love, but learns to love by meeting a mongoloid who, through acting up in hugging trees, quite literally, teaches the businessman to feel again. Most people that I know were just appalled by it, but the local Cannes audience gave it a 10-minute standing ovation. It's the kind of film that I think that would make, you know, Walt Disney faint with horror at its sentimentality. It's just out of this world.
Well, how do you handle the element of spectacle at the festival?
Well, actually, the peculiar thing about the spectacle of Cannes is that when you're doing it as a working journalist, is that you're basically just constantly in a crush of people. People are trampling you to get into the screenings. People are trampling you, or you're trampling other people, to get into the parties because you've been told that Mick Jagger is there. and, you know, and especially if you're someone who works, you know, any journalist who's there, even if he doesn't want to go to the party where Mick Jagger is, knows that it's necessary because, you know, someone might assassinate Mick, and your editor will then ask why you weren't there.
It sounds like hell.
It actually is one of the most exhausting things in the world. My schedule almost every day would begin with the 8:30 screening, and there's an 8:30 screening 12 days in a row, and would usually end after one of the evening parties, and most of the evening parties would begin after the last screenings, which is somewhere between 12 o'clock and 1 in the morning. That's when they would begin. And this happens every day for 12 days.
Well, aren't you glad you can go home?
I am glad I can go home. Really, I think it's one of the funny things that you have people who come here, and they love it. And for the first two or three days, everybody's ecstatic and giddy. And by the end, you know, people have seen 35 films, and they've gone to 15 parties. You know, with some of what going to those parties entails. You know, it's not a terrible lot. I mean, to be force-fed champagne and free French food is not exactly. It doesn't qualify you for pity.
So what is the point, finally, of the Cannes Film Festival?
I think the point of the festival is two things at the same time. First, it's obviously to promote the business of film. And the festival never really talks about that, but the festival is a huge market for films. And people come from all over the world, and scads and scads and scads of films show here. The second thing is the Cannes Film Festival is one of the few places that really does choose films because they're supposed to be good. I mean, that many of the films that are in competition get world attention because they're part of this huge competition, and the selectors for Cannes have chosen them because they're good. There was a Latvian woman whose name eludes me right now who made two very good short films who won the Critics' Prize for short film, and what that probably means is that her government will give her money, and she'll have a career that she might not otherwise have. And finally, that's what's really wonderful about this festival, is that it gives a big boost to all sorts of things that really never have the advertising money to get a big boost. The Mike Leigh film, which will be opening in the United States, you know, has a very good little distributor named October Films, which brings out lots of very good films, but it doesn't have a huge budget to advertise. But now it can say winner of the Cannes Film Festival on it, and that will guarantee it a much bigger audience. And so that's finally, I think, the important point about Cannes.
Is there a movie everybody was buzzing about at Cannes?
Yeah. The most buzzed about movie at Cannes was probably Trainspotting, which is the English heroine film, sort of the Hard Day's Night of heroine. And it was the film that showed in the middle of the festival, and it's a very buoyant film, and people were so happy to see it. And everyone knew it was going to be a big film. I mean, people talk of it as being the Pulp Fiction of England, or actually of Britain, because it's actually a Scottish film. And so that was a movie that, you know, it had the hottest party. It had the party where the rock and rollers from the bands Blur, Oasis, and Pulp showed up, Mick Jagger was there. It was the ticket that everybody wanted. It was the T-shirt that everybody wanted. It's actually a very cool T-shirt. I got one. It's orange and says Trainspotting on it.
But were you at the party with Mick Jagger?
Was I at the party with Mick Jagger?
Yeah. Did you go?
Oh. I was at the party with Mick Jagger, but I never really saw him. The problem was the Cannes parties have thousands and thousands of people always pushing and crushing. But it was, you know, it was a party that cost $250,000 for a film that cost $2.5 million. So that actually they spent a tenth as much for the party as they had for the film.
Well, makes perfect sense.
It does make perfect sense, and I think, you know, it will be a big film.
Did you like it?
I did like it. I think, you know, when it comes time to talk about it, I mean, I think, you know, Trainspotting's a really fun movie. And it's very reminiscent of 60s British movies and incredibly enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I wish you a good night's sleep and a good trip home.
Okay.
And thanks for talking with us.
Oh, sure. It's always a pleasure.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic, and he's film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.